You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There have been plenty of books written about the influence parents can have on their children, but few have looked into the effect children have on their parents. In her new book, All Joy and No Fun, Jennifer Senior examines how the simple act of having children changes parents' marriages, careers, hobbies, friendships, and their very sense of who they are. In a glowing review in last Sunday's New York Times Book Review, Janet Maslin called the book, which is published by Echo, astute, eye-opening, and smart and helpful, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jennifer Senior back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
And later in the segment, we'll be taking listener calls about how becoming a parent has changed their lives. You can reach us by phone at 212-433-9692 or write us on our show page by going to WNYC.org. Also on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Jennifer, I've seen several news stories that report that couples without children are happier than their counterparts with children. And in your book, you cite a study of 900 working mothers in Texas by Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. Didn't many of them say that they'd rather shop for groceries or vacuum than take care of their children?
They did. And every time I hear that data point, I just want to fall off my chair. And what's amazing about Kahneman's study is that the women were not actually aware of what they were saying when they were filling out the questionnaires. That's what makes this study so particularly devastating and kind of merciless.
They were doing a survey and they were ranking things. Childcare ranked 16th.
Exactly. It was an unconscious ranking. I mean, Kahneman did not set out with any explicit intention to look at how happy women parents were or how much women liked spending time with their children. What he did was he wanted to devise a system to figure out how much people enjoyed what they were doing over the day. So he had all of his participants like fill out forms saying what they did every 15 minutes and whether they were engaged, whether they were bored, whether they were miserable, whether they were excited, whether they were. And it turned out just at the end, after he looked at everything and tallied everything, that there was just an unbelievable amount of negative emotion associated with childcare.
And why do you think it ranked so low? Because it was boring or frustrating or made them feel lonely?
I don't know. I think anxiety might have been, there's a lot of stress and anxiety associated with childcare. So that could be one reason. These were all working women. So it's conceivable that, you know, when they came home, it wasn't a haven. You know, the shot clock was still running. Because women, when they come home, they're on this crazy deadline schedule. It's not like leisurely, you know, chores that they do. It's dinner at 6:30 and then bath at 8 or, you know, homework. And, you know, there's a lot of nagging. So these are not positive emotions necessarily. I mean, by the way, these studies are not necessarily designed to pick up some of the more miraculous and transcendent feelings that parents have. It might be one of their greatest failings is that they don't always do this.
Several mothers told you that they felt they'd been forced into becoming the family nag.
Yeah. And it is statistically borne out, unfortunately. They do a lot more nagging. They once kids are older, they are the ones who enforce the screen time and who nag about, like, who's that friend and do I know them and what's their number? I mean, this is actually borne out in big longitudinal studies with, like, large samples. And it's pretty depressing, yeah.
Well, we're talking about mostly middle-class people. When I was growing up in a poorer family, my mother didn't bother nagging. She just simply said, wait until your father gets home.
Yeah, it's completely true. And I have to say, I grew up in a middle-class family, and my mom just said, get on your bike. And if I told her I was bored, she would just tell me to clean my room.
So things have changed. And we'll get to that. The subtitle of your book is The Paradox of Modern Parenting. Can you explain the paradox for us?
Well, it is actually, a reference to the title, right, which is All Joy and No Fun. That kind of the moment-to-moment strain of parenting can be pretty acute, as is evidenced by Danny Kahneman's, study. But that the joy in it, I mean, what is so positively transcendent and kind of awe-inspiring and meaningful about it, it's almost at odds with this kind of daily drudgery.
Well, they may be unhappy while they're doing the day-to-day work of raising children, but when they look back on it later, don't most of them tend to remember the time they spent with their kids with great fondness?
Oh, my God, yes. It is like sort of suspended in this halo of privilege in their minds. Absolutely. I mean, it occupies very special real estate in the brain, you know, those parenting moments. And you are actually isolating something that Danny Kahneman also focuses on. He's got this wonderful kind of little linguistic distinction. He says that there's a difference between the experiencing self and the remembering self. So the experiencing self is the self that goes through life and makes all the decisions and does all this stuff. And our experiencing selves as parents might not be, you know, particularly happy from moment to moment. We might be experiencing a lot of strain. But our remembering selves find parenting just glorious.
You've called parenting a high-cost, high-reward activity. Do parents experience more highs and more lows than people who remain childless?
That is what the latest data says, and it's a 1.5 million person data set. So it's a pretty reliable one, and it's done by a Princeton economist named Angus Deaton and a fellow named Arthur Stone, who's super smart at SUNY. I want to say it's Stony Brook. And yes, that seems to be the consensus, and it's been borne out in smaller studies too.
Are those highs and lows at least in part the result of the intensity of the bond between parents and their children?
I think that that is precisely it. I think that there is something so emotionally kind of compelling about, you know, Christopher Hitchens, of all people. I don't think of him as being an emotional man, or didn't think of him as being an emotional man. He wrote in his autobiography that having kids is like having your heart, you know, racing around in somebody else's body. That has to be associated with a very high level of affect.
And that would probably would mean that the bond is more intense than with one spouse.
Yeah. I mean, I think that certainly if you ask people to consciously rate whom they feel the closest, you know, kind of deepest bond to, it's their kid. That's definitely true. If you ask Americans, they will all say that's, yeah.
And doesn't having children often give people's lives purpose and structure that might be lacking otherwise?
Yes. And this is something that Viktor Frankl talked a lot about. He talked about the Sunday neurosis, that, you know, people on Sundays can feel very melancholy because they have nothing to do. You know, the work week is over, and if they have nowhere to put their energy, it can be a really hard day. And I don't think many parents feel that kind of Sunday melancholy. It adds real purpose. And he also would say that it adds meaningful tension, that it adds structure. You know, that an architect, if they want to strengthen an arch, will add tension to it, paradoxically. They'll add more weight to it. And you could argue that that is precisely what children do.
Janet, well, first of all, let me tell my listeners that my guest is Jennifer Senior, spelt as you might expect. Her book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Janet Maslin pointed out in her New York Times review that you were able to find a number of really interesting middle-class parents to interview for this book. But you were focusing on middle-class parents. The story would be different if we were talking about poor people. What about wealthy people?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. And just one quick correction. She reviewed it for The Daily. The Sunday review is coming this weekend.
Okay.
So just to let people know.
Well, she is the Daily Reviewer.
Yeah, exactly. So it was in Mondays. Yeah. So
I had a long weekend.
That's good. One should always have a long weekend. So it would have been a different book. You're absolutely right. And I'm glad you asked. So if I had included poor parents, it would have been hard to separate the problems of poverty with the problems of parenting. I mean, if you have to take a bus 90 minutes each way to go to work to your minimum wage job and you can barely make ends meet, how can you separate that from the trials of being a mother or a father, right?
Well, do studies suggest that parents once saw their children almost as employees but now more like their bosses, which would not be the case with poorer families or rural families where kids are expected to do chores. So they're expected to do a lot of work automatically because that's part of the rhythm of life.
That is still true. And it's probably, and I think that there are greater expectations placed on children too in poorer families. You're right. There is also, I find this interesting, just having read ethnographies about poor families, there seems to be a greater expectation of gratitude you know, that you should thank me. I'm your mother. I brought you here. And, of course, middle-class parents never think that way. You know, I mean, they are working in the full service of their kids. But I do want to point out, I also sliced off, I did not talk to very wealthy families for this book, or even a lot of upper-middle-class families either.
Is it your sense that their attitudes are different?
It's just that they, no. I think that their attitudes and middle-class attitudes are similar.
I mean, there was that kid who got off on a drunk driving case where he killed somebody because they said that he had lived such a privileged life he didn't understand his responsibilities.
Wait, not in my book. You're talking about
no,
in the world?
Yeah, oh. Yeah. There's a news story a couple of months ago.
Goodness, I was going to say, wow, I don't remember a word of that. yeah, because he didn't understand. Oh, my goodness. They considered that a legitimate excuse?
Well, you know, it's the sort of thing that drives a Huffington Post. So.
But I'm so interested in the jury selection process there. I mean, I can't believe that 12 sympathetic jurors actually thought that. I mean, here's the truth. No, I think the difference, if you've got more money, is just that you can throw you can throw that money at some of your problems, so it's a little bit easier to reclaim your time.
Well, you've written that the word parenting wasn't widely used until relatively recently. Has the way children are viewed in American society changed pretty dramatically since the end of World War II?
Very much so. They now lead a thoroughly sheltered life.
Is this a boomer thing?
It's actually a post-war thing. So it's what it really is in some ways is an outgrowth of the progressive era, but then kind of the war changed things temporarily. During the progressive era, people started to realize that it was immoral to make kids work. But kids were working until then. I mean, they were sometimes out-earning their fathers and certainly out-earning their mothers. But young girls were working too. They were called little mothers. They were taking care of the house and the kids. And I mean, kids worked. And right until 1940, only half of Americans got high school educations. I mean, so think about that. So,
but there was also the Depression.
There was the Depression. So, and during the Depression, there were actually efforts made to keep kids out of the workforce because so many men needed work. But, of course, there were ways around that. And then when there were sort of relaxed rules, too. I mean, when you know, we had our boys sort of fighting, younger kids were also doing some work, too. But right after the Second World War, the sheltered childhood, as we know it, began. And kids uniformly graduated from high school. And that was that. We protected them. We worked for them.
Many couples today wait longer to have their first child than they did several generations ago. I'm sure that's a factor as well.
It is. I think it's a factor.
We see them as more precious as a result?
I was just going to say, I mean, think about this, just the scarcity principle. The fewer of them that you have, the more, you know, kind of inclined you are to assign high value to them. So certainly, yes. Also, I can just say, though, that there's another side to this, which is that I think if you wait a long time to have a child, you are acutely aware of kind of what you've given up. Right, because you had a long time to luxuriate in your autonomy beforehand.
You write that children are the last binding obligation in a culture that asks for almost no other permanent commitments at all.
This, to me, is very profound. Stephanie Kuntz, the historian, wrote about this. She wrote that, and I really have not been able to shake it, that the American conception of freedom is one of freedom from things, from obligations, that it is this notion of subtraction. And so what's interesting to me is, right, we all think of freedom as I have the freedom to leave my job. I can leave my husband or my wife. I can leave my hometown. I can leave everything. But you can't leave your kid. And that might be a reminder to us that maybe we shouldn't be thinking of freedom this way. That freedom is kind of pointless unless you have something to give it up for, you know? And maybe it would be nicer to think about freedom as like, oh, how wonderful that I have this privilege, that I have this flexibility to give up in order to bind myself to something larger.
Even though Chris Christopherson wrote freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Yeah, and Janet sang it really great, you know? What are you going to do?
Jennifer Senior's book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. It's published by Echo. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Jennifer Senior, who is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. She wrote an article called All Joy and No Fun for the magazine 4 years ago, and now there is an expanded version, a book of the same title, subtitled The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, published by Echo. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's take a call, this one from John from Clifton, New Jersey. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Good afternoon. My question is, you spoke about the relationship between a parent and a child superseding the relationship between a spouse, between spouses.
Wait. Did you say superseding, or did you say that the bond was just more intense?
Only that most...
It
was only that most Americans are inclined on surveys to actually describe that as the most important relationship. That's it.
My question is, does it work in the opposite? Is the relationship between the child and the parent the same?
Oh, my God, that is such a wonderful question. Now, here's the thing. If you ask adult children, they're going to still probably say no. And unfortunately, I don't think enough surveys have been done of kids under the age of 18. It's a brilliant question. And I think only Ellen Galinsky in a book called Ask the Children has ever even done this. So now I'm going to go and look.
John, thank you for your call. It's my sense that part of the process of developing as a person requires us to start rejecting our parents at a certain age. And then later, when we're older, we accept them, or we hope that we accept them again, but accept them in a much more adult way.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you can tell from any child's picture, if they're 5 or 6 and their parents are at the center, that it's probably true that those parents are at the center of their lives. When they're 13, we know for a fact that that starts to change dramatically.
Carolyn on Twitter sent us this: until I had my son, I never met anyone I would kill or die for.
Oh, my God. May I steal that?
Of course.
It's so deeply profound, and it explains Medea. You're saying kill or die for.
That's the only person she would ever kill for.
I thought she was saying that she was worked into that state of rage, and I was going to say that's so unbelievably honest to say, oh, yes, of course, you would gladly have an organ removed. You would gladly, you know, push a bus over. You know, I mean,
if somebody was threatening
it's astonishing the things that you would do. Oh, yeah.
Well, what was the reaction to the article that you published in New York Magazine? I'm assuming this book grew out of the fact that there was a reaction.
It did. Well, it encouraged me to keep going. The fact is, what the book kind of grew out of was that I had so much left in my notes, and that almost never happens. Usually you're tapped out after you write a magazine story. I thought one of the best criticisms of my magazine story was that it had not adequately taken on what it meant to raise adolescent kids, and that's really where a lot of the, you know, kind of heartache is. So I wanted to do that. The reaction at the time was really lovely. I mean, people really appreciated, I think, sort of swinging the telescope around and looking at parents.
You were here last time, exactly a year ago, to talk about another article you wrote for New York Magazine called Why You Never Truly Leave High School. Are you making it a specialty to write about the process of growing up?
That's very funny. I'm writing about this all from the parents' perspective. So, and also, why you never leave high school is also about our adult selves. And so I'd like to think that I'm just kind of looking at ways we experience adulthood, but maybe as it intersects with children. It's a shrewd question. I have to think more about
it. Well, I think that an awful lot of people grow up when they have to deal with the child. It's quite different when you have your first child from what you imagined.
Well, yeah, you're it. I mean, I'm loath to say that people who don't have kids haven't grown up, because I think there are all sorts of ways one does. But, I don't really have any, you know, dog in that race. I think one can grow up in a million ways. But it's true that, you know, it definitely forces you to start taking serious, you know.
And you discovered in your research that having children can put a great deal of strain on a marriage in all kinds of ways. Children generate more arguments between spouses than any other subject, including money and in-laws.
And annoying friends and sex. It's amazing. Yeah. And actually, what the bulk of the arguments tend to be about, it seems, are chores. Which makes sense because, of course, we don't have any scripts in this brave new world we're living in where, you know, 50% of all women are working full time if they've got a kid under the, you know, three or over. So, I mean, this is a really big sea change. And we are just bebopping and improvising our way through it. We don't know what we're doing.
Because the parents, at least in theory, try to divvy up the chores. But it never, they never seem to feel that it's fair.
I think that women often feel like it's not fair. I think that a lot of stuff seems to sort of fall back on women, not because their husbands are neglectful at all. In fact, if you like look at this as a straightforward mathematical proposition, men and women are working the exact same number of hours. It's just that women work more unpaid hours and men more paid hours. The thing is that childcare can be very stressful work, and I think that, and women do about twice as much of it, and I think that they would really love to have some relief on that front.
And then many mothers and fathers tell you that they feel especially resentful that their spouse left them to do the most emotionally difficult jobs, like setting limits, putting young children to bed, enforcing rules.
Right.
Both sides.
Yeah, exactly. I think that there's this anguish about being the bad cop, and you know you know, dad gets to be like the fun guy. In fact, I think that's an exact quote I have from a mother who said it, not bitterly, just kind of sadly.
Well, of course, grandma tends to be the real fun person.
Yes.
And because she doesn't have any of the responsibilities, grandma and grandpa don't have any of the responsibilities of setting those limits. They just have the responsibilities of being loving and bringing gifts.
Non-calorie chocolate, as Dan Gilbert likes to say.
One couple you interviewed, Clint and Angie, appeared to have set up a workable cooperative system that they could both work and care for their two children at home themselves. But didn't they work different shifts at their jobs so that one of them could always be at home with the kids?
They did. Angie did not quite work full time. She worked 70% time. But they did. They had absolutely no help. And man, is that a recipe for exhaustion.
But all and they... Each of them felt that the other wasn't caring for the children as well as they cared for them.
Actually, it was a little different. I mean, what was interesting to I take your point. I think that they each believed very firmly in their own styles. You're right. I think.
Well, he said he was satisfied with the way he dealt with the children. Angie felt that she could never do enough. And she told you she always felt guilty.
Exactly. I mean, the most striking thing in that whole conversation happened on the second day that I was with them, where I asked each of them which they found easier, their work or their role as a parent. And Clint, who sits at a desk, thought it was much harder to be a dad. I'm sorry, thought it was much harder to be in the office and thought it was easier to be a dad. And he declared to me, I'm the standard when I'm at home. And Angie, who works with psychotic patients and has to worry about getting kicked and hit and screamed at, found it easier to work with psychotics because when she was at home, she felt tyrannized by other standards, not her own standards. She felt like she was never doing enough.
My guest is Jennifer Senior. Her book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, is published by Echo. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And we're also taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Tiffany from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Hi. I love the name of the book, and I'm actually really glad you mentioned that story that you just told about that couple before my call, because I feel the same way. And I also want to bring up that Texas study about parenting and how it ranks lower on the list. I feel like the word parenting and being a parent, they're very different things. I have two young children. I haven't even hit the teenage years yet. But parenting as an action seems like that negative part that you're talking about, where it's all the disciplining and dealing with the kicking and screaming, whereas, you know, being a parent and the fun part and being the fun guy, that doesn't seem like parenting to me. That's playing. So I understand why people say parenting is hard and why it's not that much fun. It's kind of not that much fun. Playing and the joy parts, I don't see as being parenting as much as, you know, when you just say parenting, I just see the negative side of it more than the whole.
Well, let me just say, you're either a genius or you've read part of my book already and are totally quoting verbatim a woman in it. Her name is Nancy Darling. She teaches at Oberlin. She's a psychologist who said to me almost like word for word what you said, there is a difference between parenting and being a parent. One's active, one's passive. And the passive state of knowing that one is a parent and just taking a wild kind of sense of pride and accomplishment in your kids is a huge deal and just fills you with pleasure. And also, you know, if you consider being a parent just like kind of playing ball or, you know, playing Clue or, you know, not the kind of stuff that's happened since the 1970s when parenting became a verb, when it seemed like this professional obligation where we had to optimize our children into these perfect creatures. So exactly. I second and third that.
Now, we've been talking about heterosexual couples.
Yep.
Did you speak to any same-sex couples?
I'm glad you brought that up because it is one of the deep sources of shame for me in my book.
Because I would imagine that two women would resolve these things a little differently. Two men would resolve these things a little differently.
And there's starting
well.
To be some great data on it. And when I started doing the research on my book, there was a little bit less. I mean, the data about gay couples is still, I think, rightly focused on, you know, how does this affect the mental health of the kid? And it's all great because the answer is doesn't change a thing, you know, which we all sort of knew. But it's harder to find more refined data, although it's there. I invoke a couple of studies that look at gay women. But in terms of like looking at couple profiles, when I was in Minnesota, which is where I did a great deal of my research, the gay parenting groups didn't invite me to come in and sit with them. So in this one particular statewide program. So I felt awful. I think I should have redoubled and quintupled my efforts to have done it. So while I do cite some studies, there are no couples in the book. And if I ever have a chance to remedy it, it'll be like the first thing I do.
You cited 2013 survey of European parents by Arnstein Asve, is his name?
Yeah, I think that's the correct pronunciation.
He's a demography professor in Milan, and he linked parental happiness to the availability of affordable, quality childcare.
Surprise, surprise. I mean,
which is largely lacking in this country.
Yeah, which is why the United States rates really low in, if you look across, other developed nations in terms of its, you know, parents' levels of satisfaction. In nations where there's a, you know, kind of stronger system of social support and better safety nets, parents are happier than non-parents. I mean, you know, it virtually flips.
Does it matter whether we're talking about a nursery school or a nanny or grandma, grandpa or auntie or whatever?
That's interesting. I imagine the study that Asve did and the other one that Robin Simon and her colleagues did that I cite in the books are all developed nations. I think you'd have to string apart other variables if you're looking at developing nations where it becomes more complicated. You know, it's good to have because less money is involved often in countries like that. Women aren't necessarily encouraged or allowed to work. So I think you've got a lot of mediating variables that you've got to sort through.
Ben from Oyster Bay, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jennifer. I had a question for you. I'm a nanny or manny for an extremely wealthy family, and I kind of travel around the world with them, and I sort their sports events and look after their children who I love. And so it's kind of like, I guess I've lived for the past 3 years in an unrealistic, you know, kind of family because most people don't have this kind of money. And I just kind of had a question for people my age. I'm 26. That are certain that they want to have a future children. What kind of advice would you give us in today's economy towards becoming parents?
Oh, God, bless you. I wish I had, like, a great answer for that. I mean, it's so hard. And, you know, my book is not...
But did you feel any of the people you talked to had worked it out?
Has anyone? I mean,
because you're dealing with a human being who is developing his or her own personality.
I mean, it's also hard, you know, and as you're pointing out, I mean, it's so interesting what you're saying because you're talking about like living in a world with accelerating income inequality. And here you are jet setting, you know, at the very tippy top of that. And you're knowing very well that once you raise your own kids, you know, that's not the world that you'll be in, and it's not the world that your children will face. So it's like a hugely poignant question, and I don't have great answers. All I can say is that I know that one of the greatest drivers of parental anxiety is not knowing how to cope with that accelerating, you know, income inequality, and that people exhaust themselves trying to game it by, like, teaching their kids Mandarin or, you know, doing all sorts of extracurricular things. And just bear in mind, none of us knows what works. I mean, I was told when I was growing up that I should learn Japanese because that would put me in great standing for the future. And with all due respect to the Japanese, it didn't work out that way. I mean, I'm fine not having learned it. So, you know,
well, I was going to say arigato at the end of this.
And that might be the beginning and end of my knowledge of Japanese, you know. And so, you know, what I would say to you is to be mindful, to withstand some of the pressures to, I mean, of course, provide everything that you feel that you can, but to withstand the pressures to go bananas. Because if people tell you for sure that they know what your children are going to need, I don't know how they can possibly have any idea.
New York State caps maternity leave benefits at $170, regardless of how long a mother has been working or how much she normally earns. Do we need to make more policy changes to make having a family easier?
Yes, and gosh, I didn't even know that. And I mean, that's bad news because New York State has a taste for, you know, giving. I mean, we actually have a taste for big government, at least. So,
well, they're fighting over whether we should have more extended pre-K,
right?
Pay
and,
for it.
And which would be terrific. I mean, and you know, on the local level, this seems to be a more successful fight than certainly on a national one, where I think that's a super, you know, arduous uphill climb.
I'm going to slip one more call in here from Pamela. Pamela, you have to make it quick.
Oh boy. Okay. Thank you. I'm just thinking about children in the post-war era, and Jennifer mentioning how there was a lot of working being done, chores, you know, things that needed to get done. I know technology now has changed a lot of that, but I know for myself, with my son who's 7, I really have to consciously make an effort to say, "Hey, help me with this. You know, this needs to be brought, you know, into the house, the groceries, whatever they are," because there's so much playtime, there's so much time on the computer and technology. And I was just, you know, wondering if your book speaks about that at all.
It does. And you're so right. And I don't think it's our instincts to ask our kids to actually do chores. I mean, I think that that's...
It was my parents' instinct.
I know, and mine too. I mean, we all had responsibilities, and, like, it was implicit. I mean, man, if you didn't do them, you know, like, it wasn't... I mean, you were insubordinate. So I do indeed talk about that and how we've replaced all of that with, like, thinking we're supposed to entertain them. And it means kids can't actually entertain themselves or figure out how to be productive, by the way. There are benefits to making kids do stuff.
Jennifer Senior is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Her book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, is published by Echo. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much for having me here.